Thanks. So I have to actually begin this talk with an apology. Not an apology for the talk, but an apology for not being able to participate in the conference as a whole as much as I would like to and as much as I normally would. But I heard that once Sidney Coleman was asked to give a talk, and he said he had nothing to talk on because he was renovating his house. And at the time I couldn't understand it, but now that we're renovating our house, I have a sense of it. And if you're selling a house at the same time, it takes up a lot of time. But if on top of that you picked up some infection, then, well, you can see what happened. So that's the basis of the apology. So I want to begin the actual talk. I want to start by thank Akeem and Justin for inviting me, because I've actually been thinking about something that sounds a lot like the subject of the conference. It has to do with discreteness, cutoff, Lorentz invariance, and it has possible cosmological applications. I haven't actually pursued any of the cosmological applications, but in fact, any of the applications really. So what I want to do is just show you what comes out, and then leave it to all of us to think of possible ways that it might influence cosmology. I guess Robert has already thought of some, but maybe in a slightly different context. So, I forget the exact title of the conference, but is it a cutoff or discreteness? Was it UV discreteness or UV cutoff? Something like that. So I'm going to start with the idea of discreteness, and of course, that'll be discreteness as a causal set. One other thing I wanted to say, in an introductory nature, is that I think the organizers said to prepare an hour talk and then leave a half hour for questions. So if I prepare an hour talk and go leisurely, it'll take an hour and a half anyway. So I tried to prepare a half hour talk, and so I hope there will be plenty of time for questions and interruptions, clarifications. So if we start with discreteness, then there, of course, one wants to know what physical effects can one expect from this. And some of them you would, I think, automatically think of just by analogy of other situations where discreteness is present. But one of them is rather new, at least to me it was new, and that's the one I want to concentrate. Let me start with the old ones. Discreteness yields a cutoff. You might say that's almost the definition of discreteness. But in the context of causal sets, what's special about it, it's in a sense inevitable about it, is that it leaves it the kind of cutoff that doesn't do violence to Lorentz invariance. Second thing that you might expect from discreteness, thinking back to atomic physics, is that you would have some sort of fluctuations associated with them. And this is, I think, closely connected. Associated with fluctuations is some kind of scattering in propagation of waves in the discrete medium. As you know, in the case of classical physics, fluctuations are associated, for example, with Brownian motion, are seen in Brownian motion, fluctuations associated with the discrete nature of atomic matter. And scattering, for example, the blue of the sky, can be understood in terms of fluctuations, either scattering from the individual molecules of the air or in terms of fluctuations in the density associated with the underlying discreteness. In the case of space-time discreteness, arguably, I would certainly argue that associated with 1 over root n fluctuations is fluctuations in the cosmological constant, and that, I would argue, accounts for the non-zero value of the cosmological constant and the so-called dark energy. That's not what I'll be talking about today, but just to make the big picture. In the case of scattering, this will be scattering in propagation of particles through space-time. And that could be, one can argue, and one can give a phenomenological theory what am I writing? Pardon me. One can give a phenomenological description of this scattering. It's a scattering in velocity space, or it's a diffusion in velocity space, characterized by one unknown phenomenological parameter. Because of the Lorentz invariance of the underlying setup, it's a very highly constrained problem, and it's totally characterized, at least for a massive particle, by one free parameter. And with some hope, although it's only a hope at this point, that that might have something to do with the generation of high-energy cosmic waves. So these are some of the things you can find references to on the web and so on. But all of these are pretty much an analogy to things that you find in non-relativist physics, in the discreteness, just replace the discreteness of matter, that is the fact that it's made up of atoms, replace that with the discreteness of space-time, a la causal set, which brings in the Lorentz invariance. Now the new thing that seems to come out is a kind of non-locality associated with the discreteness. And this is what I'll mainly be talking about. And if this is true, I mean, you'll see it's not an absolutely airtight argument, but it's pretty persuasive. I would have not hoped for this, actually, but we seem to be forced to it in trying to understand how we could describe propagation in a scalar field in a causal set. If it's true, then, so it's non-locality on, I should say, intermediate scales. So intermediate, I mean something much greater than the Planck length, where by Planck length, I mean whatever the fundamental length is associated with the discreteness, the cutoff length associated with the cutoff. So there'll be non-locality on some intermediate length, which is much greater than the Planck length, but still, of course, much less than ordinary macroscopic length, since presumably if there were non-locality on ordinary macroscopic scales, we would have seen it already. This means, and this is just a suggestion, basically, especially for this conference, this means that since there's this non-locality, it's going to sense curvature, not only locally, but I mean, it's going to be influenced, because the propagation of the scalar field is going to be influenced by the curvature, and that must have, although I don't know what it would be, it must have some effect on a scalar field in an expanding cosmos. Okay. That's kind of the big picture, and in a sense, just the outline of what I'll say. Now I'll try and concentrate on this non-locality and try and make fairly careful outline, at least, of the way the argument goes. Okay, so I guess I shouldn't ask for questions today. Anyone will just interpolate questions when they want. Okay. So is that? Yeah. So this is the outline again. The outline of the part is non-locality. So the first point is that discreteness can respect the Lorentz transformation. This is the kind of discreteness that you get in the causal set, and in fact. One could really be, this is a general statement, there are Lorentz invariant versions of cutoffs and discreteness. The only actual concrete example I know of is the causal set, but there may be others. But if we limit ourselves to the causal set case, then there's a stronger statement that's not written here, which is that they really must respect Lorentz invariant. That is, from the basic hypothesis that space-time volume reflects number of causal set elements, it seems to follow that you must also, the correspondence between the discrete and the continuum must be implemented by Poisson projects, which means, in less fancy language, a random sprinkling of points into a space-time. And if that's so, then it automatically respects the Lorentz transformation. So the idea that this hypothesis that volume, which is one of the two basic hypotheses of causal set theory, that space-time volume equals number of elements, that forces this Poisson correspondence, this kinematic randomness, And then that leads to Lorentz invariant. So, there's no theorem there, but it's a fact that no one knows any other way of setting up the correspondence than this. That is the correspondence between the discrete and the continuous. In any case, with that correspondence, you do have a Lorentz invariant kind of discreteness. This has a dramatic consequence. It means that locality goes by the wayside. It's not really possible to mix together Lorentz invariant discreteness and locality. I'll try and make it intuitive why that's the case. So what has to go, since we've kept discreteness and Lorentz invariance, what has to go is locality. That means that at the Planck scale, there will be a fundamental and a radical, I should say, non-locality present in any kind of propagation law or effective action, whatever you write down. If that fundamental, I guess you can call it effective, any action you write down, the fundamental scale, which I'll call the microscopic scale and denote by small l. Yeah.
But Rafael, if that non-locality were to be only on the order of the Planck scale, it wouldn't be
so much of a concern. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. So that's exactly right. And so the next statement is, one can recover an approximate locality at large scale. If we couldn't, of course, that would be the end of that series, because we know we have an approximate locality at large scale. I'll call that the macroscopic scale. And here's the big but. What appears to be the case now, and this is how I thought for many years, just as you were saying, this non-locality would be confined basically to very small, very high energy or very small scale effects that we wouldn't have any direct access to. But it appears that the residual non-locality survives at intermediate length scale, what I'll call here the mesoscopic scale, lambda naught, which is a sort of threshold. And if you're at shorter than lambda naught, you'll see this non-locality, and this lambda naught has to be much greater than the Planck time.
This is totally mysterious to me. I would understand if you said that because of boosts, large distances could be boosted to very small distances, and then therefore you would see the effect. But if that was the point, then you could always take arbitrary distances. That wouldn't be a lambda naught. It would be just arbitrary.
Right, I sympathize entirely. So just bear with me and see whether you're convinced in the end. It was a sort of surprise to us. I should say this was a surprise to us, too. So that's how it looks now. So I'll try and lead you through the chain of reasoning that ends up with this conclusion. So suppose that this is true, that there is this residual non-locality, then there will be some, at the mesoscopic scales, where the continuum starts making sense, we're no longer seeing the discreteness as such, but the non-locality is still surviving. At those scales, we would see some theory which is continuous but non-local. Presumably, it'll be some sort of non-local field theory that make a suggestion, a very concrete suggestion as how that field theory would look, at least in terms of classical propagation. I don't have to give you a definite suggestion for how the quantum field theory would look. And I'll illustrate all these claims with one special, simplest case, which is by far the easiest to do in a causal set, which is a scalar field propagating on a fixed causal set. So we're not doing quantum gravity as such here. We're treating the causal set as background. And the question is, how can we recover the D'Alembertian operator on the causal set? Of course, if you can recover the D'Alembertian operator, the box operator, then, of course, you can write down a classical wave equation, the end of the discrete analog of the wave equation. And you ought to be able to
expand
the universe. So in the...
In the D'Alembertian, is the universe expanding?
The D'Alembertian, that I'll show you concretely, makes sense in any geometry, but it's only been verified to work well in a flat geometry. I believe it works in general, but that we have no proof of that yet.
Sorry, don't you expect that the mesoscale should appear in the differential operator?
It will. Oh, yes, it will. That's right. So it'll pair the parameter and the differential entropy.
So it's not box.
Oh, right. It's not really box. Okay. Exactly. In fact, I'll call it, this one's just a sort of introductory slide, piece of paper, really. I'll call it box of k, and this k will be a length to the minus 2, and that'll be the parameter exactly that you're asking about. As I said before, I would maintain that the fluctuations of lambda that were predicted by cause-effect theory are have actually been seen. And in any case, they, if they're correct, they are also a non-local effect of discreteness. But that's not what I'll be talking about today. So I want to go through the points. So the first point was that discreteness and Lorentz invariants are compatible, and that kinematic randomness plays a role in that, specifically in Poisson process. So what am I talking about here? So I sort of been assuming that everyone knows what a causal set is. That's probably not true entirely. But let's just say that it's some discrete model of space-time. And the only important thing for this discussion is what's the relationship between the causal set as a discrete structure and a continuous space-time. So in other words, under what circumstances would we say that a given space-time continuum, a given manifold with a metric, is a good approximation to a given causal set? And the idea of that, the idea for that, that does justice, the only idea we know that does justice to this fundamental assumption of volume equals number. Let me step back for a second, since some of you really won't know what a causal set is in any detail. Okay, there are two basic hypotheses, two basic assumptions that go at a kinematic level into the causal set theory. One is that the number of elements is what gives us volume information, what gives us scale, what fixes the scale of things. And the other hypothesis is that the causal set is a partially ordered set. It's a set of elements carrying an order relationship. And the other hypothesis is that order relationship directly corresponds to the causal order in the continuum. So the way to implement, so to put those two things together, you get the order, from that you get the conformal metric, and from the volume information, you get the scale factor, and you put that together, you have enough information to get a Bohr geometry or any kind of geometry you like. That's the underlying idea. But to make that more precise, you have to come up with some rule that tells you when would a given space-time continuum, a given Lorentzian manifold, be a good approximation to a causal set. And the idea is that a causal set C is well approximated by some manifold M with a metric G, if and only if there's what's called a faithful embedding. What that means is, if and only if you could imagine that the causal set was realized as a subset, a discrete subset of that manifold. In other words, you could find a set of points in that manifold which carry the same causal relationships as the points in the causal set, and which are uniformly distributed at unit density. So that's important. Uniformly distributed is the hard thing. It's very hard to get a set of points uniformly distributed in the Lorentzian manifold. And in fact, the only way that we know how to do it is by this Poisson sprinkle, but that's a Poisson process. So in other words, if you knew what manifold you wanted to reproduce from the causal set, instead of starting with the causal set and finding a manifold to approximate it, you can go the other way around. There's this famous saying attributed to Jacobi, which I'll have on the slide again, which is "Man muss immer umkehren." This is an example. First example. I don't know. It's something to do with abelian integrals or something like that. But this is an example. So we're turning around, which that means one should always turn back in the other direction. So we can, logically you go from the closed set to the manifold, but in trying to set up this in, this correspondence, we turn around, start from the manifold, and go back to make a causal set from it by sprinkling points in at random. So you take, and here's a picture of it. You take, this is a two-dimensional case. Is this as clear as it can be? It's clear enough, right? Okay. So you, this is a two-dimensional, portion of two-dimensional Minkowski case with points sprinkled in. The causal relationships aren't shown here, but the light cones are 45 degrees as usual. If you do that, then you have a truly uniform distribution of points in the manifold. I would claim, I won't take time to show it now, but that any other rule you think up for distributing the points won't lead to a truly uniform distribution. In particular, some regular lattice is not actually uniform, although you might have thought so at first.
You said if you do that, you get a uniform distribution, but that was what?
That was running a Poisson process in this. So a Poisson process means, I mean, it has a precise mathematical definition, but intuitively it just means take a number of points roughly equal to the volume of the Poisson fluctuation, and throw them independently into that region with a completely uniform probability distribution.
As if it was raining.
As if it was raining, exactly. Yeah. Put this down and let it rain until you've accumulated the right number of points to reflect the volume. Now you're going to set up points. And that will produce a uniform distribution that's uniform in any Lorentz spring.
But if you started with your process set, and you don't know the manifold yet, how can you read off from the causal set with the dimensionality?
That's an excellent question. I don't need it for this talk, but there's a lot of work on that. So we have there's a fractal dimension that you can define called the Mirheim-Meyer dimension that will reproduce up to small fluctuations the manifold dimension. You do it by, you count certain parameters, you take what's called an interval in the causal set, which is the set of, it's the analog of an Alexandrov neighborhood, it's the set of elements causally between two elements. So you take such an interval, it's not just too big, you see that you start seeing the curvature, and you count the number of elements, and you count the number of ordered pairs, of related pairs within the interval. You take the ratio, so here's your interval. You count the number of pairs like this, called the total number of them R, divide by n choose 2, where n is the number of, this is some interval in the causal set. N choose 2 is the number of pairs there might have been, so that's what Jan Mirheim calls the ordering fraction. And there's a simple function that you invert it, and that gives you the dimensionality. But that's one way. There are other ways, but that's.
But is there an intrinsic reason why those causal sets would have integer dimensions?
No, the question why they would, that's a much deeper, right, so that depends on the dynamics of the causal set. Why should it resemble a manifold at all? And I can just endorse the question. I can't give you a good answer yet. That's the big missing link in the whole picture. What about the dynamics will make it be like a manifold? So what I'm trying to illustrate here is that this does in fact achieve uniformity. So the number that what's a Poisson distribution in one frame is a Poisson distribution in any other frame. You know, I'm telling this to people, usually I found that there's about 50-50. Some people find it almost impossible to believe and some find it not worth even proving because it's so obvious. So this, the next slide is for the first class of people. So we take this and then we're going to carry out a boost on this and see whether it changes. So when we say it's Lorentz invariant, of course we're not saying that there's some fundamental action of the Lorentz group on the causal set. We wouldn't even know what dimension really Lorentz group we should be talking about. What we're saying is that when the causal set is well approximated by some when the causal set is well approximated by some continuum, then and there will be at least locally some Lorentz group acting there. And if it's Minkowski space globally, there'll be a global Lorentz group. We're saying that the relation, that way that the causal step sits inside the continuum under that approximation does not select any frame of reference. So it's in that sense that we're talking about lattice invariance. And I'll give you an exact theorem, I'll give you a very rigorous theorem to that effect, but let me try and bring out the intuition behind it first. So here's the spring grid, and then if we take, just so you can see better, a little box and blow it up, this is what you see. Now take the same thing and apply a large boost. So this is a boost as an active transformation. So this whole square goes under the boost into this diamond. And take a little square out of that and blow it up. This is what you get. So if you look closely, of course, you can see that in detail, this is not the same picture as this. But I think you'll also agree that it doesn't look fundamentally different. That is, if you looked at those, you wouldn't be able to say which is the boosted frame and which is the rest frame. You see essentially the same picture in both.
So this only means something when the causal set is approximated by a manifold, right? It doesn't mean anything otherwise.
That's right. Whereas if you, I said I wouldn't do this, but maybe I just will to belabor the point a little more. If you took something that you at first sight you would think of as a uniform embedding, this is like a nice diamond lattice within two-dimensional space-time, it also looks uniformly distributed, right? But if we were to boost it, you would get something that looks hard to draw. If we boost it enough, you get some very fine set of points, then a huge gap, then another fine set of points. And you can see, well, it's just, I'm just squashing it down this way and stretching it out this way. This is, of course, completely non-uniform. And what's more, it looks completely different from this. So this thing does distinguish a frame. It's basically the frame, you know, that runs through sort of the vertical set of points. It's just like a crystal. It has certain distinguished directions. This does not have any distinguished directions. So in the same way that a fluid doesn't break rotational invariance, but a crystal does, what's unspring doesn't break Lorentz invariance. And as I say, it's the only case, the only kind of distribution. This is worse than the
crystal. I haven't understood how you drew the bottom correspondence.
Oh, this is just a blow-up. This is a blow-up. Oh, you can't see it. You can't see it. There's a little square here, which has actually happened to be chosen to sit in the same coordinate location as this square, as this little square up here. Mm-hmm. And that little, yeah, you can't see it at all. There's a little square here, and it's blown up. It's just a little square of the same size is blown up to get this. So the point is, whether you look at it before or after the boost, you see basically the same random distribution. A random distribution remains random.
Isn't there some sense of you have to look over a big enough region to get boost invariance up to a given boost?
That's absolutely right.
So is there, do you understand quantitatively the relation between the maximum boost under which your thing is symmetric and the size of the region? I mean, I'm confused because if size is dimensionful, I guess there's points. Can you tell me the relation between a region of how many points will be boost invariant up to what boost or something?
Well, but if this was Minkowski space, I mean, this was, you know, if we had sprinkled all of Minkowski space, then there'd be no limit on the size of the boost that you could do. But if you, you know, like in the real world, there's some curvature and the approximation of Minkowski space ceases to be good at some stage.
No, I mean, that's not really what
that's
I mean.
What you mean.
Take it to be infinite.
Okay.
Now look at some little piece of it. There are just finite number of points in there. So really, there is a particular frame defined by those.
By
points.
Those, right.
So, you know, I have to look. So that's what I'm asking, really. What is the relation between the size of the region I look at and the
boost?
Amount of symmetry?
Oh, I see what you mean. If we were just to limit ourselves to that. I mean, so what's happening here is that most of these points, even if we took the same region, most of the points you see here are not the same points there, because under the boost, some have flowed out to another place and some have come in. So there's a rearrangement of the points. So I think you're asking, how many of the boosts have to be so that rearrangement would be relatively small?
The way you've been speaking with that little square that you mentioned, and then I asked my question, if delta n squared is divided by n, and that little square is much less than 1, then your construction holds true. It seems to me to be the more.
Yeah, it's probably choose n out of the total number of parts of n. It's probably accuracy.
I'm sort of thinking that. I mean, it will depend to some extent on the shape of the region, but if we assume something not too irregular, reason, I think it'll just be order one before you start.
If the number of particles clearly will work, then you just get a homogeneous. Mm-hmm. But if you choose too little particles or too many particles out of the total number, clearly it won't work because you need the left hand side, you clearly see the homogeneity. And if you choose exactly two or three, you also can clearly see the inhomogeneity. So it will roughly grow as choose n particles out of the total number of particles that you spring in. And that would be exactly.
Was that your question? No.
That will be a warning.
I think we've all understood your question in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. There was a question that said that there are these finite size effects where you will get some breaking of Lorentzian range from that. Mm-hmm. You could ask how rapidly do they disappear with that.
Yeah,
I feeling is that they'll disappear exponentially, but I don't know how to make that precise. I haven't tried to make that quantitative. I'm not sure. That would be my feeling. So that's not your question. Is that your question, or is it just?
I'm not sure what my question is.
But I think probably that the problem one has with this is, like, you have a certain number of points, you have a certain density, a certain average density of points out there.
Right.
And of course, when you see the picture, although, well, in the lower picture, you have the same amount of points, but in a smaller area. So intuitively, it should look like you.
It's not in a smaller area, sorry. So if you look at the original one is just this.
Okay.
So in fact, it's a crucial thing about the Lorentz transformation. That's why it all works. That Lorentz transformations preserve space-time volume. So whatever area, this is two dimensions, so this is area. So whatever area these took up, it should be exactly the same area. Sorry, I should have pointed that out.
Yeah.
That's why this is in the same coordinate location. So in the first picture, it was in the upper right, here, down here, because that first diagram is only that lower corner.
So if I didn't know anything about the causal set motivation, can I understand your result of saying that that what you're doing is take a certain kind of discretization of a continuum space, and what you're saying that if the discretization is random in the Poisson sense, then the usual argument for the breaking of the Lorentz invariants doesn't go through?
Exactly. Yeah, module of the question. I'm not sure what the usual argument is, but whatever it is, it doesn't go through. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Okay, so that's the intuition. There are no more questions on that. So let me show you, I'll just quote you the theorem. It's actually not too hard to prove, but I won't take the time out to prove it, which makes this precise. So To state that theorem, I have to introduce some of the language of probability theory. So let me start with one. Well, so Poisson process, I already give you an intuitive idea. What it is mathematically is a stochastic process, and as such, it's defined by a measure, a probability measure on sample space. And sample space is just the space of all sprinklings, all possible results of a sprinkling. So before you tell one particular sprinkling, but there are many others possible. Each of them has a probability, so to speak, and it's the Poisson process that gives them that probability. So you can turn it around again, Karen, I guess, and think of the Poisson process as defined by the probability. So that's mathematically what it is. That's known as a measure of mu on the space of all sprinklers. Now, what would it mean to say what is not written here, but that's what I wanted to mention. What's not written here, but what's important behind this is that the process of sprinkling, the Poisson process itself, is Lorentz invariant. That is, if you were to, I get your definition of it, you know, sort of take a square, choose x and y coordinates, or t and x coordinates uniformly and randomly in the relevant interval, that'll define the Poisson process in that square. To extend it to the whole space-time, you have to take many other squares, sort of tile the space-time. That's, if you like, a definition of the Poisson process. But if I could have used a different coordinate system, would I get the same Poisson process? The answer is yes. That's not the theorem I'm referring to. This is a stronger statement, because it's possible that the process is invariant, and yet its individual realizations are not. So an example of Johansson was a roulette game. So as you spin the wheel and the ball spins somewhere, that's a totally rotationally invariant process. But obviously, the individual outcome of the process is not invariant. It takes a particular direction. The ball spins in one direction. So you might worry that if you were in the class of people that didn't find the whole thing obvious anyway, you might worry that sprinklings would be like that, but the process is a Lorentz invariant one, but the individual outcomes do select the thread. This is a theorem that shows that that's not the case.
I was just talking with the second guy in here. So, Poisson process images the measure on the space of those sprinklings.
Right.
Is that to say that the Poisson process produces sprinklings with different probabilities? And so, basically, each
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the intuitive idea. Of course, really, each individual sprinkling has probability zero.
It's
like, yeah, there's a density associated with it in some generalized sense, and that's exactly what this measure is.
Is this independent of either the number of points or the density in some sense?
Two points
gives me a direction.
Two does, right, but which two will you take?
Okay, so you're saying when you average overall in some sense.
Right, so that's right. Yeah. The density, if you change the density, you change the Poisson process, although in a rather trivial way, just by a rescaling. The assumption here is that the density is always 1. So you might say 1 in which units? The answer is in the real units, right? In the units such that the density is 1. In other words, there's a fundamental length associated with the discreteness, and if we use those units, then the density is 1. We don't know what that is, but there's reason to believe it's up to a number of order unities, the Planck density. There are many kinds of reasoning leading to that conclusion.
What you're saying is you take two of the random points, if you just choose them at random, and you calculate the space-time length in between them. That will be independent of the reference.
Well, if you choose them completely at random, then I don't know. You'll get an infinite length of thing, but if you choose, two in some vague sense, nearest neighbors or something like that, but you can, that's right. Okay, so we're trying to show the very strong sense in which the null frame is selected, so this is a strong sense of Lorentz invariance. So what would it mean that we could select this frame? So like Rob had a rule, just pick two points, but he didn't specify which two points we were supposed to pick. If he had specified, then that would be, if you could have, that would have been a rule, and it would have selected, it would have given a sprinkling, would have given me a frame, or at least a time-like direction, let's say, time-like. So what is such a rule? If you could do that, then what I would be finding would be false. So that's, such a rule is just a mapping from the space of sprinklings to H, the unit time-like, the hyperboloid of the unit time-like directions, the mass shell, if you like, in space-time, the unit vectors in the function. The claim is that such a F cannot exist. Well, if I state it like that, it's nonsense, because of course, such an F does exist. So Rob just tells me which direction he likes. And I throw away the sprinkling and I always give out that direction as the answer. But that's a rule that takes me from a sprinkling to a direction. So obviously, the direction is not based on the sprinkling. So we have to put an extra condition that it is based on the sprinkling, which is equivariance, which is that if I take the sprinkling, get a direction from it, and then I boost the points of the sprinkling, I should get the boosted direction. That's equivariance. If I put that condition in, and I make one other very weak assumption, which is that this rule is what's called a measurable function, I won't try to define a measurable function, but I'll just mention that I think it's a safe assertion that no one will ever give a concrete example of a non-measurable function. Thank you.
Sorry, I could confuse because that, I mean, in mathematics, there is a notion of a measurable function. That's not what you mean.
That is what I mean, yeah. A measurable function from the space, the sample space, the space of all
spaces. In this particular case.
In this case, yeah. I'm going, in the theorem, I assume, as a technical assumption, that this function, this rule for giving the direction is measurable. And I'm just trying to point out that that's a very weak technical assumption.
But sure, you can hook up functions that are measurable.
You can, I don't think you, I think you cannot hook up functions that are not measurable. You can prove the existence of not measurable functions using the axiom of choice.
Yeah.
But if you have to use the axiom of choice, what? But.
I'm not sure actually. It's either compatible or incompatible with the axiom of choice, the strong one.
Yeah, I think you're getting at what I was. In fact, it's true that if you drop the axiom of choice, you can trade it for an axiom that says every function is measurable. And that's the consistent
set of axioms. So it's for practical purposes.
But for all, certainly for all practical purposes. You'll never, this is not like something that's continuous or anything. This is something that you'll never be able to actually get away from. And naturally, it's not a crucial point. In point, there's this technical assumption, and then the theorem is that there's no such gap. Not even on a set of partial domains. So that's maybe not worth going into that detail. But basically, it's not. Yeah.
Is it proved by contradiction? I mean, what breaks down? I would suspect equivariance screws up, but.
Yes, in a sense. I mean, it's hard to say which one screws up, but it is because it's a proof by contradiction. That's right. And the thing at root of it, and when I show the picture in a second, I think this will make it clear. The thing that's at the root of the whole thing is the non-compact nature of the Lorentz group. The fact that the Lorentz group has an infinite volume in our measure or whatever. That infinity gets into the proof and basically shows that something that you get measure zero, any set that the set of string things that would produce the direction of measure zero. I mean, that's another thing. A sprinkling could give you a direction. For example, if you go to Syracuse, if you've been to Syracuse, there's a sculpture in the sculpture garden which looks like this. It's a picture of Moses or something. I don't know, a sculpture of Moses. So you could get a sprinkling that looked like this. It's not very likely, but it could happen. So that would be a sprinkling that picked a direction. But instead, the statement is that with probability 1, that won't happen. As the mathematicians say, it's almost sure that you won't get that kind of sprinkling.
I assume from your language that when you said measure, you really meant measure in the bona fide mathematical sense.
Right.
But I'm reminded of the kind of statement like, you know, measures on infinite dimensional function spaces are hard to come by.
Oh, yes, this is
the point here is that it's really not so infinite.
Exactly. This is not as bad, this is nowhere near as bad as an infinite dimensional function. It's just a countable selection of points.
I'm confused. Can you just say, you just forget about relativity and think about the rotation group, which is compact. You can't really think of sprinklings that would be rotationally.
Yes, approximately. Yes, sure.
But then you can't prove that by the methods that you should.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. So usually you used to think that everything to do with the Lorentz group, the Lorentzian signature, is harder than the corresponding Euclidean signature. But we cannot prove the equivalence theorem for the rotation group, although we believe it to be true. I mean, I don't think that if you sprinkle. Three-dimensional Euclidean space, that you would be able to derive a direction from that. But we can't prove it, just because of the reason that you said. Whereas we can prove that you can't derive a distinguished time-like direction.
Maybe if you combine that translation.
Absolutely, yes. If you want that, sir.
Yes.
So in fact, I could have said that it doesn't break the Poincaré group. I mean, I put it as a far greater concern of the Lorentz group, but we get a somewhat stronger statement by even allowing you to distinguish a point, so you can get it fix a point, and you're only dealing with Lorentz, so it's giving you a little head start. Even if you do that, you still can't get a direction. So even if you said, I don't want an overall direction, but let me take for each point a direction, a sort of direction field or something like that, you can't even do that. That's what the theorem tells you. Okay, so let's. So now, this leads directly into the intuitive explanation of where is the non-locality coming from. So in some sense, this is the most important. For understanding, this is probably the most important diagram. The rest, I mean, there's a lot more to come, really. I suppose I have to speed up a little bit. That wouldn't happen. But for understanding where the problem comes from and why the solution brings in a non-locality, this is probably the most important. So suppose we were trying to define a D'Alembertian on a background causal set, or as I should say, something as close to a D'Alembertian as we can. We're going to end up with this. Suppose we try to do that, how would we go about it? So first of all, what do I mean by doing it? So let the causal set have been be well approximated by some Minkowski space or some portion of the Minkowski space. Here, take everything for two dimensions. Most of the talk will be for two dimensions, although in the end I'll indicate how it goes to four dimensions. So let's start with two dimensions. Suppose we have a scalar field defined on this portion of the Minkowski space, and we want some discrete expression which would reproduce to a good approximation the D'Alembertian of that scalar field. That's what I'm trying to do now. So the analog of the Laplacian operator is very familiar for people working with various lattice theories. And there it's very simple. What you do is you just take the sort of nearest neighbors and you take their value and you average them out and compare it to the central value. Anyway, you just take some simple algebraic combination of the value. If you want the Laplacian at a given lattice point, you take some algebraic combination scalar field at that point and it's nearby neighbors, and that gives you the Laplacian. So why can't we do something just like that in the causal set? Here's the problem. Let this be the element. We scribble the point here, and we want to know the value of the Laplacian, of the D'Alembertian, of this field, which remember is some isodrama field, some imagine some slowly varying field on the space-time. Then you might say, take its value, compare it to the nearest neighbors, take some difference in combination, and that will be the D'Alembertian. So first of all, what are the nearest neighbors? Well, the nearest neighbors, in the causal sense, if that can be defined, they're the elements that do have a causal relation to this element, but there are no intermediate ones. So sometimes it's good to use the language of ancestry in this, to think if X precedes Y, if X precedes Y, we can call this one the ancestor, and this one the descendant. If it's actually a parent child, in other words, there's no intermediate people, there's a direct causal link, then you can call that a nearest neighbor in some sense. The next thing would be like a grandparent, you know, there's one intermediate, and so on. So we could take the nearest neighbors and take some differences and then add them up appropriately, and that could be the D'Alembertian. That could be the idea. Well, the problem with that is that in an infinite Minkowski space, there's an infinite number of nearest neighbors. In a very large but finite space like our cosmos that we live in, there'll be a very large number of nearest neighbors. And why is that? Well, it's the Lorentz invariance. That's the Lorentz invariance plus discreteness is incompatible with locality. If it's discrete and it's Lorentz invariant and there's a nearest neighbor here, then there's equally likely to be a nearest neighbor anywhere that you can get to by boosting this, which is to say anywhere along the lifetime, out along the lifetime of this point. And since that's infinite, you get an infinite number of nearest neighbors. Are very large but finite. The important thing is that most of those nearest neighbors are not near in this frame of reference. They're very far away. And by taking differences, you won't get a good approximation to a derivative. You'll get some sort of global, very global, globally defined object. So why not, just these red ones are meant to be the good ones. This, I think it's supposed to be green, but I don't know what it looks like here. But anyway, that's the bad one you want to throw out. There's far more of these bad ones than these good ones. So why not just keep it? Well, you could, but then that'll work fine for fields which are slowly varying in this frame. But if we boost that same field, it's now rapid, it gets blue shift, and it's very rapidly varying in this frame, but it's slowly varying in some other frame. The good nearest neighbor for computing the Laplacian Talamberton of that field is this one here, and these become the bad ones. So if you want to do justice to all the possible fields, you need all of these, but you need somehow it has to do a miracle. It has to know which ones to keep and which ones to throw out to compute in any given case. And if you want to make it seem even more miraculous, consider a test field that's itself Lorentz
invariant. What made you draw the dotted line in the first place?
Oh, that's meant to show an approximate local neighborhood in this frame of reference.
But for that you need a length scale.
Yes.
So you go into that frame and you measure, for example, space-like length or something like that.
Yes.
And in terms of that space-like length, you decide to draw a space-like sphere.
Right, that's right. And that frame is the one in which, or one of the ones in which this test field is the Laplacian and Talamberton.
You yourself in that frame,
yeah.
There, and then in another frame, it becomes normal.
Right, right. So that's the essence. If you take a test field that's itself Lorentz invariant, and this, for a long time, I was convinced this was a reductive ad absurdum to the whole enterprise, is that if the test field is itself Lorentz invariant, then it looks like all these links have to contribute equally. And the only answer you would get would be infinity or zero, which is both the wrong answer. The real answer is minus two in this case. So it's very hard to see how you can get around that. But in fact, you can, and that's what the rest of the talk is about. And then the cost of that, however, is some residual non-locality.
The answer to what is minus two?
The bound version of this particular test function.
Are you saying that we're bound by measuring the devices which we have in hand, for example, the measurement of the spacing on our, the way we measure space, the way we measure time? Us. And then we draw that sphere to the left.
Well, yes, and the only thing that...
Otherwise we don't have...
Because there was a test function. The problem is that I omitted from the figure. I omitted the test function. So we're imagining some phi, which might have been this particular phi, some particular phi. Now, if we want to approximate box phi, we can't hope to do it if the test function is varying too rapidly, right? I mean, if you have a discrete structure and you imagine something of a much higher frequency, is it the Debye length or something, you can't go beyond that. So the test function has to be sufficiently slowly varying in order to have any hope of doing this. But because of the Lorentzian nature, what's slowly varying in one frame is not slowly varying in another frame, because there can be a blue shift, there will be a general blue shift if you boost enough in any direction. So what makes this frame special is this is a frame that goes with the test function that I chose. So that's the objective character. So it is relative, but it's not relative to our measuring instruments. It's relative to the function whose Talamberton I'm trying to evaluate. Okay. So there's a characteristic length scale typically associated with that function. But in some frames, it'll have a much smaller wavelength than that characteristic length scale.
You say we'll make a square minus t squared is invariant, but we only allow certain values of all.
Well, that's good. So this test function doesn't have a characteristic frame associated with it. That's true. So this was an arbitrary choice. That's the worst case. I was trying to argue I couldn't even see for a while how you'd ever cope with this function. But a typical garden variety function will have distinguished rest time associated with it. The one in which its wavelength is long, extensively. It will, I mean, if you like, a typical function will have, I mean, it'll have a gradient, and that points in a certain direction, and that determines the frame. What happens with this function is that at that distinguished point, its gradient is zero, so it doesn't determine the frame, but a typical function will determine the
frame.
Locally. Locally, yeah. Yeah, and that's right. Globally, it's a very vague handwriting statement. So this is all meant to be intuition. So how could we overcome this? Well, let's go back to an expression that you may or may not know. But it's a very common expression for the D'Alembertian that you can write down if you are on a regular lattice. So if you have a diamond, this, I draw this again, well, it's no better here. This is meant to be a square, like a baseball diamond. It's just drawn poorly. So this is all consisting of all null edges, right? If you wanted the D'Alembertian of a function here, slowly varying on this scale, the following works. Take the sum of the values on the top and bottom, subtract the sum of the values on the two sides, and normalize appropriately. That will give a good approximation to the D'Alembertian. So this is something, this is a little more sophisticated than this, and it just assumes points at null directions that you won't really have in the positive self. But let's follow it a little farther. Suppose we were to now boost it, go through the same thing, and say, well, these are the good ones. This is like these red points here. These are the ones we want to contribute. But then under a boost, there's this other one. And that's the example that we don't want, one of the ones we don't want to contribute. It's very long and skinny. It's reaching well out of the region where this function is slowly varying. Well, here's a good thing. Now we can see a glimmer of why it might not contribute, because I can rearrange this sum. It's this distance, this difference, minus this difference. Okay. But now notice how these are shrunken down. So this difference is actually a very small number if the function is slowly varying, and this difference is actually a very small number. So there's some hope of an automatic cancellation of just the sort that we needed, that we said we needed. If somehow it does know which frame it should choose for the function. So that's just an intuitive idea. And now I'll give you an exact expression that realizes it. Okay, so I think I'm going to maybe speed up a little bit. So this is the simplest expression. Now, everything I'm saying now is in two dimensions for a while. All this general discussion was really for arbitrary dimensions, but now we're limiting ourselves to two flat dimensions. Although flat really shouldn't matter in two dimensions, we have a conformally invariant situation. But if you think these through, and I'm obviously leaving out a few steps, but if you think it through, you're led to the simplest expression that I know you're led to that could work is of this nature. So it's telling us how we compute the D'Alembertian at the point that I've labeled here O. So here's a small subset of the causal set, which you can imagine as having been produced by sprinkling into two-dimensional and Minkowski space. And we're looking at the D'Alembertian, we're looking for the D'Alembertian at this sprinkled point. You take minus 1/2 the value of the field at that point. You take the sum of all the field values at the level 1 point, minus twice the level 2, plus level 3. You add it all up, and you normalize suitably. By this, aside from the 4, that's the density of the spring. L is meant to be the characteristic length scale associated with the spring, which the microstructure of bond length. That's the expression. What do I mean by level 1? By level 1, I mean what I called before parent, the immediate causal neighbor. By level 2, I mean what you might call the grandparent. So here's an example of level 2. There's one in between.
Isn't the other one a level 2 as well?
Right, good question. So So if we were in Korea, the answer would be yes, I think. Because I believe in Korea they talk about relation one, relation two, relation, instead of saying parent, you can say not relation one and so on. But maybe it's two, I forget how it's normalized. Sibling is relation two. So they actually talk about relationship in terms of the shortest path to the causal set of the family tree, I guess you could say. But here, for technical reasons, it's easier to call this tree. So the level is defined by the number of the total number of intermediate ones. So instead of the longest path, which is the Lorentzian analog, the shortest path, you just count up, here's this one, here's this one. In between are two of them. So we call that level three and not level two. Okay. And this is also level three. This one is what you would have naturally thought was level three, but again, there's two in between. So that's the actual definition that's being used. I doubt that it would make any difference if you use the other definition. The coefficients might change a little. But this is the one that's easy to analyze. So that's the definition. Now what you can prove, so let me just point out, what this is telling us, more abstractly considered, is that our approximation for the Dalembertian at the I causal set element is just some matrix, Vik, acting on the column vector, if you will, of field values on the causal set. And I've written up here, I've just rewritten that rule I gave you as an explicit matrix. It's a matrix which has minus one half of the diagonal, and some ones, and minus twos and ones in other places, and the rest zero. Okay.
So now I'm not thinking the right way. I would have thought to approximate a Dalembertian that the sums of the numbers ought to be zero.
It is. Oh, good point. Very good point. So it is in some sense zero, right? Because one, aside from the strain here,
it's minus one half.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know what to say. Yeah, you're right. But it's almost, I mean, there's a lot more of these than there is of this one.
I don't understand.
It's to do with the random, I mean, if you put in a constant, you need that minus, as a test function, you need that minus one half five to,
well,
to actually get zero.
Puzzle about it is, if, let's say you had many, many intermediate points, at one level and not at another level, doesn't that throw it off completely? I mean, that is, make it not approximate. I don't see any division by the number of points at a given level or something.
Well, but there's this 1/4 over L², so when I come to the later non-local expression, it'll change. This only looks at levels 0, 1, 2, and 3, nothing more.
No, but I mean, let's say I fill in 10 more points at level 1.
Oh yes, that's
add them all up. I don't divide by 10. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's why I thought, in some sense, it was impossible. That's the thing I was talking about before. But they contrived to cancel out. So.
Well, how do you get
there? Let me make the full thing because there's some caveats, and they may make you a little happier. But all I can say is it works. Right? There is some sort of miracle going on.
How do you get statistically, you mean?
You're saying, so I'll tell you the exact state.
With Poisson process causal sets, it's going to work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you get these numbers, Rafael?
Right. Trial and error. So
I would have thought you'd take the differences of differences and then differences of differences of differences.
Well, that's, I know a better way to get them now, but if you ask how did I really originally get them, it was by putting in tests. Well, can you hold that question a little bit, because the answer will make more sense after I say some other thing.
Can I just ask, is Vik symmetric?
No. I should have. This is arranged to be retarded by choice. It could have been symmetrized, that would have changed anything.
But is it done version self-adjoint?
No, that won't be. But this is arranged retarded because if you make it retarded, then you can, it's very convenient for propagating a field, right? Because then the value, you want to update the value at some point, or you want to put in the value at some point, its value is related to only to those in its path. So there'll be one equation for one unknown as it goes into the propagation process. Whether or not this retarded thing is the right thing to do, the quantum field theory is a very interesting question. I won't comment on that, but for classical evolution, this is, I think, the most convenient short.
But if you were to use the Dalembertian in the action, you want the action to turn out really, and if the Dalembertian is acceptable, then?
Okay, so I think the answer there, this is more speculative, I think the answer there is that you want to use what's called the Schwinger-Kelvin theorem, which is, you may, I don't know, it's used normally for finite temperature field theory, but in that formalism, you double the fields. You consider what Dirac calls closed time paths, and I think that you end up working with the sum and difference. I mean, it's a long story, but in that case, I think that the retarded Dalembertian doesn't have to be self-derived in that case. But that whole thing is something I'm not too sure about. So, anyway, here's what we can prove is this, which is, let's take any test function of compact support. I think it's not written here, but imagine a test function of compact support. Do a sprinkling, compute this, imagine that the sprinkle, suppose this point will always make sure it's in the sprinkling, and then we'll compute this expression for the sprinkling, and then we'll take the mean, take the average over all sprinklings that you could have done with respect to this Poisson process. The statement is that that average, which I call here S, converges to the correct answer as the density of the sprinkling goes to infinity. So that's the first precise result.
So,
but it's only an average.
If I have a constant to phi on the first line at each point, then the result will not be zero, it will be some number.
The result will average to zero.
But when you average it,
yep,
that constant is zero.
Exactly. But there's a slight caveat, which is a constant is not a function of compact support. So you would have to put, if you want to apply this theorem, it has to be constant for a long way, and then sort of slowly rolling off to zero. And if you do that, it will average to zero, or some tiny number, depending on the effect of this distant region. But, okay, so the second, how did I get, well, I won't go through the proof of that, but just mention what goes into it. So you have to average. So these expressions are very complicated, but when you average them, you're sort of dealing with the mean, you know, with the probability density for finding a parent or a near state or anywhere, the probability density for finding a grandparent. The average can be written in terms of fairly simple integrals, of which I just gave one example. The thing to notice here is that this integral has an exponential. U and V are null coordinates here. And so UV represents the volume. And this exponential is just e to the minus volume. It's essentially what's called the Singh world function. It's the square of the proper distance. And it's exponentially damped out. So what you're getting is contributions from the light cone or things near to the light cone falling off exponentially as you recede from the light cone. And the scale of falling off is this set by this L, the fundamental scale, because that's the distance to the nearest neighbor. But, okay, so far, so good. But there's a problem, which is that I told you the mean comes out, right, the mean converges to infinity. As I take sprinkling density higher and higher, or if you like, as I take the plot length to be smaller and smaller, the sprinkling density at the mean converges to the right answer, but what about the fluctuation? What happens with the variance? So the bad news is that the variance goes to infinity. So if you take your constant function and compute, you're likely to get, as I take the sprinkling densities higher and higher, I'm likely to get a larger and larger answer, but if I do it enough times, it'll be driven down and the mean will be zero. Now the question is, is that a disaster or not? My feeling is that, yes, it's a disaster. And the rest of the talk is based on the assumption that it is a disaster. But it's not altogether clear, because, for example, suppose you're trying to propagate the scalar field forward by this wave equation. Well, you're doing this evaluation of the Dahlenbergian over and over and over and over again. You might think that these fluctuations would be damped out by the law of large numbers. I'm not entirely sure that that doesn't happen. If that did happen and these fluctuations were a disaster, then we could stop now and say we have a satisfactory expression for the Dahlenbergian. And whoever, I guess you asked about the, someone asked about the length scale on which we would see the non-locality, and the answer would be it would be confined to the Planck scale, and that would be the end of the story. But I think that these fluctuations really are intolerably big. But without having worked through the theory of the propagation, classical propagation, I don't know for sure. So we'd have to probably do numerical experiments to be sure. So I'm going to assume that it is a disaster. We need to get rid of it. We need the fact that not only does the mean converge to the right answer, but the fluctuations go to zero. The variance goes to zero, not flowing up.
Yeah. Isn't that just depending on the fact that the sprinkling process is Poisson?
Is it what dependent?
The fact that you have this variance that's not convergent.
Well, I suppose ultimately, but I wouldn't have been able to see it directly.
Well,
I mean, we're taking some complicated sum of different values of phi.
But it doesn't look that complicated to me. It just looks like a generalization of the second order discretization that we see all the time in numerical PDEs. I mean, it just looks like you're doing a generalization of the technical approach to the Dahlenbergian.
I would like to be able to get it that simply.
But it looks like that's what it's going for, a generalization of.
In some very rough sense, but remember, it's involving this large number of contributions. So if that were true, I think what you're suggesting, which maybe is right, is that just because the points are not exactly arranged in the right place, they're moving around a little bit, that it gives this larger fluctuation. Is that what you're saying?
Because it's a Poisson process, so you don't have any regularity.
But that's certainly part of the story. But so, I mean, it could be that in the end that's the whole story. I don't know.
Is what you're saying about the divergence of the fluctuations at all related to the standard of theoretic computation of the propagator of phi of 0 to phi of 0 when you take a random walk and you come home?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And if you cut it off, it's finite, but if you've gone to the limit, L goes to zero. So,
how these facts
are related, the random walk to the.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know how the random walk is related to these.
That would be the saying that quantum phenomena arises as an emergent property of this scattering, what do you call it, sprinkling process?
Sprinkling, yeah. Well, that's a tall order. So actually, I'm almost finished. But I see that it is actually getting. What happened to?
Intuitively,
I guess I can leave this.
Even if you don't have a random sprinkling, but just regular. It's sprinkling, and a k is a wave number from the lattice. Can you take a random walk over a tremendous number of steps to get phi of 0 times phi of 0? Intuitively, does that differ all that much from the random walk and the random sprinkling?
No. It depends what your lattice looks like. If your lattice has a finite coordination number, then it differs dramatically from a random walk and a random string.
But if you take an infinite number of steps to go back, it doesn't have any mass, so you go all the way out ahead of it and come back.
No, I don't know. I think this is an important question. I would phrase the question this way. Can we come up with a sort of path integral in the old sense, not functional integral, more like a path integral, on the causal set that would describe the propagation of one
thing
particle.
Just
finding
the
thing
of that functional.
Or is it, yeah, and I mean, I'd love to know the answer, but I don't know. And this, and so the question of how this is related to that, I also don't know. But I think it's a very important question. But I, at least I can't see any simple connection. I can't see how to get from this to that in some simple way. Okay, so let me briefly, let me just tell you how the non-locality gets in. So, and then essentially we're then finished. So, the idea is we have to damp out these, and maybe they are just these fluctuations we're talking about, or maybe there's more to it, but in any case, we do get fluctuations that blow up. By the way, the fact that the fluctuations blow up as the density goes to infinity is not a theorem, that's based on simulation. It's just an observation from simulation. But I'm sure it must be true. So how would you do it? Well, why is it happening? It's happening because you're just taking, no matter how high you make the density, you're just taking the first three layers. And so, as he was saying, you're making the points get closer and closer together. And you're magnifying little errors coming from the misplacement due to the Poisson randomness. On the other hand, if we could take more layers, then we could have the law of large numbers to help us, and we could damp out these errors. So it turns out that you can do this. And to get an idea how you should do it, here's one approach. So what we saw is that the average sum converges to the right answer. But what is the average sum? Once you average, you're actually dealing with a continuum integral kernel. In other words, when you average, you smeared everything out, and then you washed out the discreteness. So the average sum is given by this sort of expression, where V of x minus 1 is just some Lorentz invariant function on space-time. And here's what it is explicitly. Remember, there was that minus 1 half that Robert was unhappy about. That's that delta function here. And then the rest, there was this exponential fall off, and that's this e to the minus c, where c is the intervening volume, this uv, normalized by k, where k is 1 over l squared, and there were the three terms in the sum, that's this polynomial. So the main thing is you just have some delta function plus some continuous function in this integral kernel, and that, when you apply it to phi, gives you the average value. And that's good. That average value converges to the right answer as L goes to zero. I've written in terms of 1 over L squared because it makes the formula look a little simpler. As k goes to infinity, that converges to the right answer. But the fluctuations get big. So what we can do, well, we don't have to send k to infinity. We can just hold it fixed, and then it will be this intermediate length scale. It will be the non-locality scale. Then we get an expression which is good for a large range of functions, all of which whose characteristic length scales are larger than this non-locality scale, but it starts to deviate from the usual downgradation when the frequency gets high. If we fix that approximate downgradation, and then this is the Unkern, and then turn around. So we started from the sprinkling we produced by averaging a continuum function. Now take the continuum function, change its length scale, rescale it, turn around and sprinkle, make a sprinkling from it, that'll lead to a new expression for the causal set, which is this one. And that one, the Planck density is still going to infinity, but this intermediate length scale, this non-locality scale, is staying put. And if you take that sort of limit, then it turns out that the fluctuations do go down, and you get everything that you want. You get the fluctuations going to zero. You get the answer converging to the right answer, except at the cost of this residual non-locality on the scale set by k. So I went a little faster than I would have liked for that.
So for all value of k?
For any value of k, if you hold k fixed and then take the limit of little r going to zero, yes, then it will converge but what it'll converge to will be this expression here with the k, with k in it. I mean, I haven't made the k explicit, but this expression has k in it. And so it'll converge to something which reproduces the validation correctly as long as the wavelength of the test function is longer than this.
So how would you mind if you get the second length scale after the distance?
So now, if you ask me physically where does the second length scale come from, that's a huge mystery. It's a mystery. It's like a hierarchy problem or something. Why should there, in nature, be another length scale than the fundamental length scale?
You don't have any.
I don't have any good answer to that. It just seems that that's what we need. But we can get some insight as to what it should be, what its value should be. That, so I guess we started a bit late, but even so.
Lambda naught is to be a proper length scale.
Proper length, yes.
Break
it, yeah, proper length. Actually, what it comes in is, really how it comes in is a volume. If you go back to that expression, you see that everything that occurred, it came in multiplying UV, and that's actually a volume. It's actually, in this case, an area. So it's actually the area. Here's the point I want, here's the point I'm evaluating. I think I called it X and Y there. That UV is just the volume of this Alexandrov neighborhood between them.
Yeah, Rafael, I just don't really understand why this is fixing the problem of the infinity that you talked about way back at the beginning. I mean, I can see that it's squeezing closer and closer to the light cone, the region that contributes with a given weight.
No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't fully fit. So I kept saying contact, test function of contact support. So if it's not a contact support, more problems come. So that's going to be the basis of my suggestion. You're right. So if we were in an infinite Minkowski space, the fluctuations would still be infinite. We couldn't do anything about them if the test function itself.
You kind of smear out the light. Are you kind of simply smearing out the light from the second length scale?
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. Yeah. Okay. So that's. So now we have two box operators playing with you. One is the last one that I had written down, which is a box operator that works on the causal set, which is a fully discrete dynamics. We also have the continuum box operator, which arose as an intermediate step, but also would be the continuum limit of the discrete box operator if we took the Planck length to zero and kept the non-locality scale fixed. And so we can operate at two levels, the fundamental level doing physics on the causal set, or some, you know, effective level where we'll have a non-local field theory based on this continuum box operator, which is actually a very simple integral kernel, much easier to work with than the continuum. But my thinking was that was this last line here, that one could examine, for example, the propagation of the scalar field in an expanding, say, a Sitter universe, which is propagating with that non-local Dalembertian, and see what one got. So just to summarize in a little more general way, these are some of the things that you might imagine doing now that we have these new tools. So before that, I should mention that everything I said was two dimensions, but there's analogous expressions in any dimension. The proofs, however, so far are limited to two dimensions. But the expressions are known in general. I'm just giving here the one for four dimensions. You'll see that the one in four dimensions derives from the binomial coefficients for three in the same way, or the binomial coefficients for one minus one cubed in the same way that the two-dimensional one derived from the binomial coefficients for 1 minus 1 squared, 1 minus 3 plus 3 minus 1. Second of all, we can now study the propagation on a sprinkled causal set and look for some of the effects that I mentioned here. I think I won't take the time to try to flesh any of this out, but we can look for some of those effects in relation to wave patterns, for example, and just a more general propagation of the scalar field on the causal set. Another comment, this is actually an answer to the question that Ted asked before the seminar started several months ago, which was, how do you know that you won't get an unstable propagation law from this? So of course we don't know in the continuum case, but there's good evidence that we don't know in the discrete case, but there's good evidence in the continuum case that you won't. The continuum, it seems that the continuum free field, massless I should say here, is stable. In other words, that the solutions of this smeared box K or this blurry box K, this non-locality put it incorporated, is exactly the same solutions as the other one. In other words, if you had nothing, if you didn't want to look at the relation to sources, you would get the same propagation law. Is there quantum field theory version? I won't even say anything about this unless someone asks me. But it seems like it can lead to a new approach to ring normalization theory in which the cutoff is actually Lorentzian in nature. But the non-locality does not, as such, remove the infinity, contrary to what some people have expected. In fact, it makes them worse. And then finally, the most perhaps the most important thing is, where is this mesoscale? What can we say about it? And this ties into the last thing that Ted asked, which was, we're living not in an infinite Minkowski space, but in a finite universe. And so there will be only a finite, even though the number is very large, there'll be a finite number of contributions to this expression. Nevertheless, if they get too large, like you were saying, the fluctuations will still win out. And one can make a very rough, it's only a very rough estimate so far. But you have to balance that against the non-locality. So if you set the non-locality scale too small, the fluctuations get big. And if you set the non-locality scale too large, well, then we should have seen it already. So what's the smallest it could be without the fluctuations getting too big? And that depends on the scale of the region over which you're doing this. We follow that if I was the Hubble scale. If you take that scale and use these, if we assume these rough estimates are right, you get this relationship. The non-locality scale should be at least as big as the fundamental scale, the microscopic scale, squared times the Hubble scale, let's say, to the one-third, some sort of geometric mean between them. If we need the convergence at each point, we need the value of this to be about right at each point with small fluctuations, then it turns out that that's around nuclear size. So we might actually already be running into trouble, or more optimistically, we might be running into something that we can really see. And so this residual non-locality might actually become accessible to observation if it isn't accessible already. And
nuclear size, that's huge.
It's huge, yeah.
Well, I don't understand what balancing the fluctuation because of the finite size of the universe against the non-locality at the Planckian level. I don't understand that.
Yeah. Let's see. So
that construct.
So by taking thicker and thicker, more and more thickening of the light point, you get more contributing points, and that drives the fluctuations down. But by extending, by using a larger region of summation or integration, you're taking a much larger portion of the light point, and that's just more points, more value contributing, and that it drives the fluctuations up. So the larger region you have to contend with, the more thickening you need to drive the fluctuations back down again. And if you work, and as I said, on this crude estimate, if you work it out for the size of the Hubble scale, you get nuclear. I'm finished. I just wanted to say that just want to stress that in addition to this discrete theory that we now have, there's an intermediate theory, which is a non-local continuum theory, and I think that's worthy of some study in its own right. And it could have direct applications to things like input patterns and zero standard inflation. So, I'm finished.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this, but this is to come back a bit to what you said around here about you having, might have quantum mechanics without having to add some more quantum mechanics. And if you're going to have non-locality at the mesoscopic scale already, why couldn't you have some sort of, you know, hidden variable thing in quantum mechanics?
I don't know any reason that you could not, but
if you have the non-locality anyway at that scale.
Well, remember, this is non-locality. Yeah, so that's an important point. The non-locality that we're seeing here is not an a-causality. So when people talk, for example, about the violations of the Bellini equation, they often call it, they almost always call it non-locality, but it's really more than that. It's a causality, right? Because it's something outside the light. But for purposes of this answer, let me distinguish non-locality from a causality. So by locality, I mean things acting at a distance, but by a causality, I mean things acting outside the light form. Now, this particular expression I gave you was still causal. It was retarded, and therefore it was still causal. It didn't show an influence acting outside the light form, at least at the level of classical propagation. So I think it's probably not adequate to produce the kind of a causal non-locality that quantum mechanics requires.
But the flat tanks could take you a little bit out of the light form, couldn't it?
Well, a little bit maybe, yes. But I think we need quite a lot for meters or something like that.
Let us thank Rafael again.